Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness, Pujya Swami Chidananda Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. How can you stop negative emotions controlling your thoughts and feelings? The brain functions in a series of habits. We'd like to think that every thought we had, that every emotion we had was brand new and fresh and alive and due only to that moment, but it's not. So much, the vast, overwhelming majority of what we do on autopilot. Now, we know that's true about our, for example, autonomic nervous system. We're breathing. We're swallowing, we're digesting, we're sleeping, we're waking. It's the autonomic nervous system. We're not doing it consciously. But there's a lot more that goes on in autopilot than just the systems of the body. The vast majority, sadly, of what we say, the tone in which we say it, what we also do on autopilot. We'd like to think we're fully conscious, making these new decisions with every minute and every moment. But most of us aren't. Most of us are just kind of moving through our day habitually. And the brain works with our thoughts in the same way. The negative thoughts that we have right now, chances are the same type of negative thoughts we had an hour ago. Chances are the same type of negative thoughts we had yesterday. Chances are the same type we had last month. Chances are the same type, if not the same content, that we had 5 years ago. Which means that if we want to change it, we have to create a new pattern, a new habit. Or we have to develop the spiritual ability to be so incredibly present and mindful with every split second that we actually are able, with every thought, to check it and change it. But that's very difficult to do and still live in the world. We have to be able to relegate some part of the process to autopilot. And this is where changing the pattern of our thoughts come in, is we take the subconscious patterning, which in many people is negative. It's judgmental. It's judgmental of others. It's judgmental of the self. It's critical. It's critical of the self. It's critical of others. It's comparing yourself to others. It's hopeless or helpless about yourself, about the world. This is subconscious patterning. It happens at a young age. We carry it through our lives and reinforce it. And the only way to change it is to substitute it with a different patterning. And this is where the science of mantras comes in. It's also where techniques of affirmations come in. I mean, even aside from Indian tradition, focused on mantras. These days in the West, there's so much in the, you know, New Age self-help world about affirmations. Why? Well, it's not just a matter of what the words are of that affirmation. It's giving yourself a new pattern. So yeah, you may think you sound really silly saying to yourself over and over again, I am beautiful and worthy and divine. I am beautiful and worthy and divine. When you start to sound like a narcissistic broken record. But what it's doing on a very deep subconscious level is giving the brain a new habit. If you can do it with a Sanskrit mantra, it's even more powerful in some ways because you've got the power of sound. As we've spoken about here, the science of sound, the science of these mantras. So it's not just the meaning of beautiful and worthy and divine. It's the actual vibration of the Sanskrit words. You want to do both? Do both. Have a Sanskrit mantra. Have an affirmation. But give the brain something new to do. Lay a new pattern. Because again, the vast majority of these thoughts are just that. It's just habit. It's not deep. It's not profound. It's not who we are. It's just what my brain does out of habit. And I want to give it a new habit. I want to rewire my brain. This is what in Indian culture we talk about as sanskaras. In science we talk about neuronal networks and patterns. We say neurons that fire together, wire together. Well, it's this, we're talking about the same thing. But it can change. And now recent science has shown that meditation changes your brain, literally. Physically, structurally, functionally, changes your brain. So that's the way to do it.
You're listening to OTRFM. Part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. The teachings of Vedanta, which literally mean the end, the sum of the Vedas, spoken about frequently to refer to the Upanishads, although later it also started including other works as well, but typically Vedanta is the Upanishads, which are seen as the essence of the Vedas. So you don't have time to study all the Vedas. Okay, study the Upanishads. From the Upanishads has come this teaching of Vedanta. That's very simplistic, but it's enough for our purpose right now. In that teaching, the primary teaching is the teaching of Advaita. Now what Advaita, the original Advaita, as taught, as espoused, as brought across India by Sri Shankaracharya was the teaching of oneness. So there is no two, because people had always been talking about me and God, worshipping God as separate from the self. So Sri Shankaracharya came in and said, no, there is one. Nothing but God. And it's important to distinguish that. We're not talking just about one God. So it's not that we've gone from many gods to one God. It's we've gone from a concept of God as something to which I pray, to a concept of nothing but God. So there is no distinction between the devotee and the object of devotion. And in traditional Advaita, any sense of distinction is an illusion. So we speak and hear frequently about the concept of the wave and the ocean, that the wave is ultimately the ocean. But in the Advaita teaching, they would say the wave itself is an illusion. The fact that it looks different than the ocean is illusory. Not just that it's a temporary form, but actually it is an illusion. That's Maya. There is nothing but God. This divine presence has no attributes, all attributes, no form, no names, nothing. It is just the nameless, formless, attributeless existence. Then came in Vasishtadvaita, which was espoused and taught by a very great leader named Ramanujacharya. Same concept. We're still in the oneness of God. But Vasishta literally means unique. So it's oneness with unique qualities. So he took the teaching of Advaita and said, yes, there's nothing but God, but that God is not entirely attributeless. Rather, there are attributes of God. So there are waves on the ocean. The wave is the ocean. The wave is not separate from the ocean. It would be ludicrous for the wave to worship the ocean because the wave is ocean. And yet, the wave is an attribute of the ocean. So that's the Vasishtadvaita teaching, is oneness, nothing but God, but with attributes, with unique characteristics that are manifest in the myriad aspects of creation. Yes, we're all God, but we're embodying different attributes, all of which are of the same God. And the analogy that he gave is that in the same way that the soul is to the body, so is the infinite to the finite, so is God to us. So the body is nothing without the soul, right? I mean, if we didn't have a soul, we'd no longer leave a body on the ground without a soul, and within a few minutes, hours, and days, it starts to be no longer a body. So in the same way that the body depends on the soul for its existence, so does the finite depend on the infinite. So does the wave depend on the ocean. If there were no ocean, there could no longer be a wave. So that's Ramanujacharya's Vasishtadvaita. Then we come into the teaching of Dvaita, which is the dualism. One other aspect, though, of the Vasishtadvaita is that he said it was, and this is why I like it serving sort of as a bridge in between the two. He said that the way of knowing this truth, because of course neither of them was saying, oh, just read my books and learn what I'm saying. The emphasis is always, always, always on learn the knowledge inside, experience it. It must be yours. It must be your truth. It's not about read the books, learn the terms, pass the exam. It's about know it and live it. But where Sri Shankaracharya had emphasized Gyan Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, as the way of knowing this nothing but godness, Ramanujacharya had emphasized bhakti, devotion. So through devotion, we would come to understand the divine, not separate from us, of which we are an attribute. But I would discover that through devotion to God. Then we come into Dvaita, dualism, rooted also in devotion. But devotion of a separateness. Now, it's very important to qualify that all of the dualists are all aware that at the fundamental level, it's all God. But with bhakti, with devotion, what there is an awareness that says, it is so beautiful. Yeah, yeah, I know I'm one with God. But it's so beautiful to love God, to worship God, to worship Krishna with attributes that are different than mine. To be the lover of the beloved. And to have this thing called love between us. That's beautiful. And so the dualist path, the Dvaita path, is a path rooted in the love of God by the devotee. I'm sorry? Yeah, we're going into even more specific lineages that I'm not going to go into here, but yes, there's many different paths within the dualist tradition. There's many different paths, different ways of loving God, which we won't go into. But it's rooted in short in the concept of the lover and the beloved as being separate. That yes, we've been created by God. God, of course, is also in me. But the God that is out there is different. And that's why I'm able to love. It's not love of myself. It's not love of my soul. It's love of a distinct divine being. The love of whom brings me that state of liberation, that state of moksha, that state of samadhi. So it's a different way of attaining. And again, it's important, I'll end here, is whatever path we choose of these three, of a different one, is, because of course when we're talking about the yogic path, we have Gyan Yoga, we have Bhakti Yoga that we've talked about, we also have Karma Yoga, path of service. Whatever way we use, doesn't matter. What matters is we connect. And there's people for whom the concept of a nameless, formless, attributeless, divine, supreme existence, that's all there is the easiest way and the most powerful way for them to connect to God. For others, a path of devotion. And within that, different ways of devotion. But it doesn't matter. What matters is we connect. What matters is that we jump in to Ganga. Whether we jump from this God or that God, off the steps, off a rock, out of a raft, doesn't matter. What matters is we connect. And all of the different schools of philosophy give us just innumerable different ways of connecting with the divine. Because ultimately that's the point. And in a way that I've seen unparalleled by any other spiritual tradition that I know of, the Indian tradition gives so many different possibilities for so many different characteristics of people that it's like there's no opportunity to say, oh, well, you know, my nature's like this, so therefore I can't be spiritual or therefore I can't connect to God, because inevitably there's going to be a path just right for you. There's going to be a way just right for you. And that's really what the point is all about.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Like Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. How can you move on after suffering a lot of stress? Well, Ganga, the divine sacred river flowing in front of us, gives us such a perfect model for this. As you know, I assume most of you know, we're very, very active in the Ganga cleanup programs and Protect Ganga programs. And one of the things that we always remind people of is that actually all we have to stop doing is putting more pollution in. Because every year when the monsoons come, Ganga cleans herself. She's this model of forgiveness, this model of moving on, no matter what we dump in her, no matter how disrespectful and horrible we are to her. Every year the rains come and whew, it's all clean. And if we just could stop dumping more things in her, Ganga would actually be clean. And it's the same model for when we talk about how do you move on after suffering a lot of stress, the same way Ganga does. If we stop putting more stress into our lives, then the minute that we're able to have a deep breath, the minute we're able to connect, the minute that monsoon rain is able to happen in our lives. The minute that we're able to be in an inner situation that may be connected to an outer situation as well, and it may not. Our outer situation may stay the same and only the inner has changed. But we have that experience of the flow the flow of that new river, the flow of that new life, the flow of that awareness, the flow of love, the flow of connection. It's what we get when we meditate. It's what we get, many of us in the Arati. It's what we get by the grace of a guru. It's what we get when we experience love. And the minute that that happens, it literally, like Ganga, washes all the junk away. It's just important not to redump it. So don't hold on to that which has happened before. Oh my God, that was so stressful. How am I going to move on? Well, the sheer fact that the stress was in the past tense, that I say that was so stressful, means it's over. Whether it's from 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago or 50 years ago, in all cases, it's in the past. And we look at Ganga, whether you dumped something in her 5 minutes ago or 5 years ago or 50 years ago, it is gone from this moment. From where I am, it's gone. If it was only 5 minutes ago, it's somewhere closer to me downstream, but it's not here. It's not in my experience of Ganga. And in the same way in our lives, when something has happened, the question is, how can I, allowing it to flow, so that in this moment I'm able to be new? Sure, there are things that happen that we have to respond to and deal with and address and solve and whatnot. But that's logistic. From a spiritual perspective, it's about how can I be new in this moment? Okay, that happened. But in this moment, it's not happening. In this moment, I have the opportunity to experience stillness. I have the opportunity to experience peace. I have the opportunity to experience grace. The fact that at some point in the past there was stress does not have to be part of my reality right now. Now again, I've simplified it for most of us. There are, of course, situations in which the stress of the past was painful, was traumatic enough, was big enough, impactful enough, that it has changed us in some way. That it has created sanskaras or energetic or neuronal patterns that we have to then address. But that's what our spiritual practice is for. It's what our psychological practice is for. But in no case do we have to bring the stress of the past into this moment. I may have to work with creating a new neuronal network, a new pattern, a new sanskara. But what's most important is not to bring that stress into this moment. And I have the power to do that because it isn't here. And if I find it here, it's because I have grabbed it out of the past and brought it here, which of course we do because we want to hold on. But that's a different question, a different situation. For this one, remember it's of the past. Remind yourself that the present moment does not have that stress. That regardless of how bad the past was, it is not happening in this moment. And I have the opportunity, the invitation, to live in this moment, not in that one. And again, yeah, I may have to deal with some things from that moment, psychologically, logistically, but I don't have to live in it. My life should be in this moment. And a lot of the the beautiful rituals that we're able to do, whether it's yajna, whether it's offering something to Ganga, whatever it is, forgiveness, is literally the equivalent of the monsoon season coming that cleans it all out of us. And then with our spiritual practice, with our dedication, with our commitment, with our vows, we don't bring that back into our life. So that the river of our life can flow freely and cleanly and purely within us.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Alec Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with Inspiration and Transformation. Here in this country, because there's such a widespread tradition of worshiping the divine in form, through form. They're not actually worshiping idols. This is something we remind people and explain so frequently. It's not worshiping the idol. It's worshiping the ideal of the divine through the statue. But there is a very deep belief that the divine has infused that image with divine presence. And I mention this because when we then construct temples around the image, the belief is the divine lives here, is actually present in this temple in this form. And the way that we take that campaign is we say, look, you come to the banks of Ganga, we perform arati. Well, arati is performed to the divine. In a Krishna temple, people perform arati to Krishna. In a Ram temple, people are going to perform arati to Ram. In a Shiva temple, people will perform arati to Shiva. When the guru goes into someone's home, people perform arati to the guru as an embodiment of the divine. So arati is performed to the divine. So we perform arati to Ganga. Ganga is the goddess, which means that her banks and her waters, her form, are a temple. If God lives there, this place is a temple. And nobody could imagine, nobody of any religion could imagine walking into their priest or their minister or their rabbi or their imam and saying, excuse me, but I don't have anything to do with my household waste. I have no place to put it. Would you mind if I brought it here and just kind of dumped it on the floor? We couldn't conceive of even asking the question, let alone actually doing it. No one would say, God, you know, I'm looking for a place to hook up my household sewage to. Would you mind if I just ran a pipe and it just, you know, came right here into the temple, into the church, into the mosque? into the Gurdwara. The concept is sacrilege. And so helping people understand. Because see, the mom analogy, that's just my physical mom. People would say, well, that's just because that's my mom in her body. But Ganga's the goddess. Ganga's the divine mom. So she's not subject necessarily to the rules that one would think apply to a physical person. Ganga doesn't get sick. Ganga doesn't need a hand across the street. Ganga, you know. But when you talk about a temple, then suddenly everybody gets it. If we are worshiping Ganga in any way, we're offering flowers, we're offering prayer, we're offering light, well, we do that to the divine. And everyone agrees, yeah, Ganga's the goddess. Well, if she's the goddess, it means that this whole form, whether there's four walls or not four walls, this is a temple. And this has actually been a campaign that has worked very, very well. This is what Pooja Swamiji did here on our God. When he first got here in 1969, there were no ghats on the banks of Ganga. It was nothing but rocks. And every morning people would go to the banks of Ganga to go to the toilet. And it disturbed him deeply, deeply from the beginning. And so he started a variety of different awareness campaigns, education campaigns. Population was nothing at that point, so it wasn't like a massive community issue. It was more for him an aesthetic issue and a deeply spiritual issue of, this is our mother. How can you poop in her? He then built toilets, attached bathrooms in all of the rooms in the ashram, which itself was a revolution. People thought that was just the grossest thing they could imagine. How can you possibly put a toilet where you sleep? Literally. And this is not 100 years ago. This is 30 years ago. Mid-80s. 1980s, not 1880s. I mean, those of us from abroad, you think, might be right, 1880s you mean, right? No, 1980s. People couldn't imagine. When he came in, there were not attached bathrooms in the rooms. People could not imagine having an attached bathroom. This is gross. We'll go outside. It's pure. It's beautiful. On the banks of Ganga, it feels so clean and fresh. So he then tried a new campaign, which was to begin the Ganga Aarti, which served two purposes. One, of course, was to revitalize the devotion that people have for Ganga, to gather them every evening together in prayer. And the very simple awareness that no one is going to poop in the morning where they pray in the evening. That by reminding people this is a temple, literally, bring them here to pray, perform the yajna ceremony, the fire, perform the arati. This is now a temple. And he then covered it with marble. And the open defecation just stopped. Not because people wouldn't defecate on marble, but because this was now a temple. We come here to pray in the evening. And so the campaign actually has been very, very successful. And now you'll see up and down the banks of Ganga, all of the ashrams have built these ghats. He encouraged all of the ashrams, build ghats, marble it over. A, it's beautiful. People love it. They sit. They can sit more comfortably on the banks of Ganga. They can meditate. He's encouraged everybody start aarti. When we first started, we were the only one. For years, we were the only one. Now, over the last few years, if you look up and down Ganga while aarti is going on, you'll see, oh, up there's one. Oh, up there's another one. Oh, down there's another one. And sometimes people say to him, you know, well, don't you mind that these other people have also started aarti? And he always says, this is what I've been trying to convince people to do for decades. when we have Aarti up and down the banks of Ganga, everyone will remember this is a temple. And when everyone remembers it's a temple, we don't need to put up signs that say don't defecate here. Because it doesn't matter how badly you have to go, nobody. In any city of the world, no matter how desperate they are, no matter how badly they're looking for a bathroom and can't find one, is going to walk into their nearest temple or church or a mosque and squat down and go to the toilet. Form and content, okay, we don't throw our trash in Ganga. Whether it's because I recognize the content as divine and therefore the place is a temple, or whether because I recognize that people depend on the form and therefore to protect them, I'm not going to dump my trash. But as you so rightly mentioned, we have this third dimension, and into that third dimension comes our much deeper existence. Because if you look at what it is that is removing Ganga, it's us. It's us. It's development, as you say. It's choices. It's us saying, for example, we want to farm in a chemical-heavy way, in a non-organic way. We want to farm crops that are not right for this area because this is what's lucrative. We want to farm with heavy fertilizer use because it's going to grant me a more lucrative harvest. And therefore, we are going to divert a larger amount of the water from our river into our farms. There's a finite amount of water. Either she's running in the riverbeds or she's irrigating our fields. And as we are developing, these are choices. Again, there's not a moral police that gets to say, thou shalt do this or that. God has granted us all free will. Some could argue that wasn't necessarily the smartest thing. But nonetheless, we've been granted free will. We have it. It's in our hands. And when prophets... my prophet today, this month, this year, overshadow the greater good. When I look at the cost of something as being only that which it costs me, but not that which it costs the earth, the water, all of the other people with whom I share this earth and this water, well, then I make decisions like, let's get into agriculture of crops that require gobs of water in places where we don't have gobs of water. Crops that are not meant to be grown here because they require lots of water. This is not a water-intensive place. Crops that take chemical fertilizers. Let's use chemical pesticides. All of this ends up diverting our water. Let's divert it to create electricity. Because what we need are more and more things that run on electricity. Bigger, bigger, more and more. We too should become like a city that never sleeps. We too should have a city where the lights are on 24 hours a day. It's our choice. And what's happening, the other aspect of what's happening, of course, is as the water level is going down, even if the pollutants were not increasing, even imagine for a moment, this isn't true, but even imagine for a moment that we were able to stabilize the amount of pollution. Well, the percentage of pollution still would continue to increase because the amount of water is going down. So the dilution is in such a way that even if the toxins that we were pouring into her stayed the same, it's still a greater dilution, a greater percentage. And the other major aspect that this relates to within development has to do with industry. Because the greatest contributors to the pollutants in Ganga are the industries, the tanneries. Not only the tanneries, they're a huge percentage of it, but not exclusively. Well, they produce in what we call the law of supply and demand. As long as there's demand for more, 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 cheaper, 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 people are going to keep cutting corners. They're going to do whatever they can do to make the cost cheaper because now they're in competition. And this is because of our internal lack of sense of abundance, lack of fullness, lack of enoughness, that I need to buy more and own more in order to feel full, in order to feel content. I mean, do we all really need that many pairs of shoes? Do we really need this many pairs of pants? Are we really living in a way that with everything we buy, we look not only at the price tag on the item, but we look at the whole chain of who and what has been impacted by giving me this item at such a cheap price? Well, somebody's paid for it. If it's not me, who's paying for it? And this is, it's an existential dilemma. It's a spiritual dilemma. It's a human moral dilemma. Because as long as I'm looking for more, 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 cheaper, 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 that's the demand. And yeah, we can blame the courts for not passing stricter laws, but the truth is the laws are there. We can blame the government for not properly enforcing it. They're doing their best. But what that does is absolves us of the responsibility. And the truth is that economics are where it's all about. I remember when I was young, before I became a vegetarian when I was 15. So sometime prior to being 15, I used to eat tuna fish. And I learned one day that the tuna industry, that the people who fish for tuna lives around dolphins. Because the dolphins eat the tuna. So wherever there's lots of tuna, there's also lots of dolphins. And the way that the tuna fishermen work, they're not going out with fishing poles and lines and trying to, you know, catch a tuna. They go out in these huge boats. They drop these nets that sometimes are miles long. And they go along the ocean, again, for miles. And then they pull up their nets. And they throw away everything that's not what they're fishing for. If I'm a tuna fisherman, I only want tuna. If I'm a salmon fisherman, I only want salmon. Everything else that's in their nets gets tossed. But of course, by that time, it's already died. And the amount of dolphins who die in tuna fishermen's nets is phenomenal. But I share the story because, so I was maybe, I don't know, 10, 11, 12, whatever I was. And I learned this, and what I was told was, you know, you can buy, Greenpeace, I think it was, ran a huge campaign, dolphin safe tuna. So they weren't saying don't eat tuna, they weren't trying to turn everybody vegetarian, but on cans of tuna fish, there would be a little logo with a picture of a dolphin that said dolphin safe tuna, as in no dolphins have been killed in catching this tuna. And everybody would only buy dolphin safe tuna. And the industry literally had to change. Similar campaign happened when Coors beer wouldn't pull out of apartheid South Africa. Everybody else had pulled out. All the other big multinational companies had pulled out in order to put pressure on the South African government. Coors wouldn't pull out. It was too economically lucrative to keep being able to employ cheap African labor. Governments put sanctions, and everybody tried to put sanctions. Nothing worked. Finally, people just boycotted Coors beer. Nobody would buy a Coors beer. And what all sorts of other sanctions couldn't do, economics did. And I share these two examples because we, the consumer, we have the power. If we created a situation where we said, okay, we're not saying don't buy leather. We're not, again, as I said, the moral police. But could you have Ganga safe leather? Could you have a certification whereby those industries who produced leather without one drop of waste going into Ganga or into the groundwater got some sort of a stamp? And then a nationwide campaign went out that we would only buy Ganga safe leather. But as long as we're clamoring for more and more cheaper and cheaper, you know, people are screaming about the government's failure to clean Ganga. And then they go out and everybody wants leather car seats and leather handbags and leather shoes and leather belts. And it's like we're shooting ourselves in the foot. We're literally going out and with our rupees, supporting the very industry that we're over here picketing against. And so what it gives us is the opportunity to really realize, wow, I've got the opportunity to make a difference. Can I start demanding organic food? Can I insist that my local grocer carries organic food? Am I prepared to pay an extra few rupees for organic food until it becomes mainstream? Can I think 10 times before I decide I need a new mobile? Or a new anything? Is the old one still good? Am I buying it because I really need it? Or am I buying it because I'm bored or I'm depressed or I'm frustrated? Am I buying it to fill a hole in my heart that it's not going to be able to fill anyway? Because if I am, I lose anyway. And then Ganga loses. And everybody loses. And this is really where you could say spirituality and activism come together. Because, yeah, we can scream about tanneries and we can scream about industries, but as long as my favorite form of therapy is shopping therapy, I'm creating more problems than I'm solving. But the only antidote to the need for shopping therapy is spirituality. Because that which is leading me to feel like, oh, if I just could have another pair of shoes, I would feel so much happier. Oh my God, I had a really bad fight with my husband or my wife. I'm going to go shopping. And I come home with 5 bags of goods and I feel better. Well, as long as that's what I'm doing to self-soothe, as long as my concept of self is being filled by things outside me, well, those things are being produced in industries that are destroying our environment. And whether it's Ganga here, or whether it's our ozone layer across the planet, that which is happening today is happening as a direct result of our actions. And this is not that we should all walk out of here and feel horrendously guilty, but we should walk out and feel incredibly empowered. Because it's not just about our state governments. It's not just about the courts. It's not just about what big multinationals do. It's actually about the decisions that we all make every day. What do I buy? What do I wear? What do I eat? How do I live? How do I fill my holes? This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week. And I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.